You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I came across some very interesting research work done recently that is, has some very important implications for our region. This concerns climate change. This concerns our switch in energy sources and the political ramifications. My guest today has written an article for the Journal of Politics about this topic, and he's just co-authored a book on this as well. Let me give you the titles of these. The article is in the Journal of Politics. It's called Sources of Partisan Change, Evidence from the Shale Gas Shock in American Coal Country. And the book is, he's the co-author of Uncertain Future, The Politics of Climate Change, How to Unlock the Climate Impasse. His name is Alex Gasmararian. And Alex, thank you for taking the time to come on today.
Thank you for having me. It's really exciting to talk about my research. And I know these issues are important, not just in Iowa and Illinois, but across the country. So I'm excited for our conversation.
So I just want to tee this up for you. There's a lot of reasons, and my show has been dedicated to this. I started this show 10 years ago, and after Donald Trump won. Why did he win? Why? And it was on the really with the help of white working class voters. And I've had a lot of guests on talking about why they moved over. You've got a unique theory here, and I think it's interesting. And as if our listeners will hang in there, this is about coal country, but I think you're going to see that there's some ramifications locally here as well. So let me just turn it over to you. Talk about the thesis of your work, the bottom line, and talk about it in general terms here, and we'll dig a little deeper.
Yeah. So, I mean, let me paint a picture of coal country. And by that, I mean, you know, places in the United States that mine for coal. So we're talking Appalachia, we're talking Wyoming. You know, these are places that have done this for decades, some early as 1900s. And what was really puzzling for me is that these are places that historically have been strongholds for the Democratic Party. You know, they were tied in many areas to the Democratic Party through labor unions, the United Mine Workers. And, you know, up until, you know, 2000, the early 2000s, you know, they were voting reliably for Democrats, including Democrats like Al Gore, who were, you know, at the forefront of the climate movement. And so for me, I found it really puzzling that we start to see around 2008, this reversal that takes place in coal country, where places that reliably voted for Democrats started voting for Republican candidates. And, you know, a lot of things take place in 2008. You have the election of Obama, you have the 2008 financial crisis. And what I want to do in this paper is just very sort of carefully, like, pin down, you know, what's happening, what is driving this shift. So I do a couple of things. You know, one thing that I do is I look at, you know, administrative data. I want to compare places that mine for coal with, like, otherwise similar counties that don't, and see how their voting's changing. And what I found is that as coal declines, you know, compared to otherwise similar places, they start voting for Republicans at higher rates. So if you look at the data, that's what it shows. But, you know, you can only get so far if you're looking at the data. You need to, like, talk to people on the ground and understand, you know, what is motivating them. So I, you know, I'm based out in New Jersey at Princeton. I hopped in my car and I drove to Southwest Pennsylvania. You know, it's, you know, 5.5 hours, but it was very much worth it, because I had, you know, just absolutely enlightening conversations with people from both sides of the aisle. So you're talking to Democrats, talking to local Republicans. And what I found in this slice of Pennsylvania, and what I think is sort of echoed across coal countries, people were upset about what they perceived the Democratic Party's climate policies harming them. They thought that these policies were threatening coal. And, you know, you hear this rhetoric from interest groups and from Republicans about a war on coal. And that sort of resonated off the charts for people. But what I found sort of puzzling in my research is that, you know, you see this backlash, and coal had declined not because of a war on coal, but it declined because natural gas got really cheap. You have hydraulic fracturing revolution. Some people call it fracking. Although if you call it fracking in Southwest Pennsylvania, you'll get in trouble. So you have cheap natural gas, it pushes coal away, but people blame policy instead of markets. And what I show in this paper is that, the reason you get this sort of misattribution is that you can't see these markets forces at work. And that makes people really susceptible from these sort of messages from politicians. And so I sort of document how the inability of people to see these changes around them pushes them towards the Republican Party. And this is sort of akin to what we see with other types of like deindustrialization across the heartland. You see a lot of backlash to trade, for example. Automation and robots contributed a lot too to the decline of manufacturing. And so it's sort of, I'm fascinated by this question of, what do people blame when sort of these local industries go away?
And it goes right along with another trend we talked about on this show, the decline of community newspapers, where the information sources are more limited and they're more almost nationalized, where it plays into national type themes. You found that as well in your research?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I want to talk, I mean, this pertains to the book. So, Dustin Tingley and I, we wrote this book, and it's looking at the sort of political problems with the clean energy transition. And the book takes a similar approach to what I did in the article, which was, we talk about this energy transition. What that means is, to stop climate change, we need to move away from using fossil fuels and use more clean energy. And we have all these policy ideas about how to do this, but we wanted to see like what does this look like for people on the ground, people in oil and gas communities, people in Iowa and Illinois where you're going to build solar panels, build wind turbines, and sort of what questions and concerns might people have, and then sort of understanding those concerns, how could we then solve them? And I promise this ties back into local news. What we find in the book is that people have concerns about sort of what we call the credibility of these policies. They're worried these policies might get reversed in the future, and the sort of uncertainty makes them dig their heels in to, defend what they have now. Here's an example of this type of challenge with clean energy development in communities. Like you have a wind turbine developer who comes in and says, "We want to create this turbine, we're going to create jobs." That promise to someone in the community might not be seen as credible. They might, what is there to, make sure they hire people from the community, make sure that they provide benefits to people beyond just, whose land the turbine is on. And one thing that we sort of found is that, people were most worried about sort of the lack of transparency around these projects in places where there wasn't a lot of local news. And this sort of is like contributes when you have the erosion of local news, it becomes harder for people to know what to trust. Why should we trust this developer who's coming in? It's not just developers, but why should we trust the government? Because people in general trust local news way more than they trust partisan sort of national news. So that sort of decline is really concerning for the ability of people to make sense of all these problems.
Here's what we've seen locally, and I've read about this a little bit in Europe and Michigan, but we've also seen it locally. The term is greenlash, and this is where this ties into your work out there dealing with coal and fracking. Where locally here, I had a state representative on from Southeast Iowa who went to a town meeting, and there was an uproar over windmills. The argument was, hey, they're taking up prime farm ground. We're not getting the economic benefit that was promised. And all our energy is going up to Chicago and big cities anyway. That's kind of what's going on the ground here. I feel like there's a little relation, somewhat of a correlation to what's going on out there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in the book, we look across the United States. So we look in places like Minnesota and Nebraska, which are also important in the wind industry. And yet one finding that I think is important to sort of hammer home is that sometimes people look at greenlash, as you called it, and say, I can't believe that people are falling for misinformation. Or they say, look at how the culture wars, has invaded our local politics. And I think that sort of perspective is dangerous in the sense of, if you talk to people on the ground, the types of concerns that they raise about farmland, about sort of the aesthetic impact, I think that, you can debate whether these concerns are real or perceived, but you have to take people from where they are if you want to change their minds. And telling people you're sort of dismissing them, saying these are not real concerns, is like a sure way to just piss people off. So as like a messaging strategy is not very effective. Let me give you an example from Uncertain Futures, the book. So we look at the case of Minnesota. And Minnesota is interesting because, like Iowa, for example, they really got in the wind business quite early. Iowa had one of the first renewable portfolio standards. Minnesota actually has sort of companies there that both manufacture wind turbines and install them. And much of the wind industry in Minnesota for decades was built by local labor, local building trades. So you had this sort of happy situation because you build these turbines, it helps the local workers, and people are much more accepting of them. That changed in, around the 2010s, mid-2010s, where you start to have new sort of multinational companies that come in. They're building it. They're much more, they don't want to hire from the local labor pool because they cost more, right? If you're a business owner, you want to make money, so you're going to try to hire the cheapest workers. But that also sort of degrades this like social contract that you have with communities, that we're going to create benefits for you, and you're going to welcome these projects, which may have some disruption associated with them. What's interesting is that the unions didn't just give up. They actually pushed for types of solutions that we talk about in our book. So the unions started going to these local hearings about sort of for siting wind turbines, and they said, if you're going to build a turbine, you need to have transparency about it. Specifically, we're not going to, require that you hire local workers, but we just want you to report, every quarter, how many local workers did you hire? And so that's what that way, if you go to a county commissioner and say, this turbine is going to create X number of jobs, we're going to have a paper trail. We can see if you actually created that many jobs, and we can see if you hired them from people here or people 100 miles away, bringing in a team from Texas, Oklahoma. And what's remarkable in Minnesota is that the Public Utility Commission, the commission that decides, the rules for how these projects, get approved, said acceded to this idea and said, we're going to do this going forward on all of our projects. And you've seen sort of an uptick in local hiring in Minnesota because of this. And this is an example that I think it shows sort of like, in absence of transparency, community opposition is much more likely to emerge. Now, I'm not saying that, there's going to be no opposition, right? Where these projects get built is sort of unequal. You're talking about how, people in rural areas feel like this is an imposition from urban areas. That's the sort of fundamental distributive conflict that's going to exist in the energy transition, because where's the best place to build wind and solar? It's not in cities. It's, you need to build a large scale solar farm, which is going to be out in a rural place. And that's, a conflict that you're going to just have to negotiate over and find some sort of mutually agreeable solution if that's the way you want to stop climate change.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and we're talking climate change, energy transition, the political impacts. My guest is Alex Gasmerarian, who's the author of a book and an article. The article is in the Journal of Politics called "Sources of Partisan Change: Evidence from the Shale Gas Shock in American Coal Country," and the book is called "Uncertain Future: The Politics of Climate Change: How to Unlock the Climate Impasse." Alex has just described for our listeners, even though this is taking place, his research out in Pennsylvania with coal and fracking, that this, I do think this has some important implications in our region as well. His book gets into that as well. I wanted to talk a little bit too about, my experience too is I just put in a solar panels in my backyard, and I found out that a lot of the firms that came in over the last 5 or 10 years came in and they've gone under. And they're not around anymore to provide maintenance. I mean, I think this is something else that as the industry shakes out, we need to be aware of. But you list some things in the book. You might talk about a couple of them. What are good ways Public entities that are working to bring energy alternatives in, and these companies, what can they do to kind of help overcome some of the questioning, the skepticism, the resistance?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea in the book that we highlight of sort of credibility, it could be that government policy changes in the future, right? Republicans get elected and change the Democrats' climate policies. Or, what might have happened in your case is that, with interest rates going up, a lot of these renewable energy companies have sort of lost the capital they needed and have folded, right? Because it's an industry that you need to borrow money to expand because it's pretty new. And so you could have these economic changes that happen that, affect the clean energy industry. So this raises the question, like, well, how do we make sure that our climate policies are more durable? How do we make them last beyond, one administration so the next one doesn't roll back? And how do we make them last so if a recession happens or interest rates change, that clean energy investment doesn't just evaporate? So there's a couple of things that we talk about in the book. One is this idea that we need to pursue laws. And this might sound simple and it's easier said than done, but what we saw during past administrations, things like Obama's Clean Power Plan, that was done at the executive level. And that meant that the first day that Trump came in, he could start to undo all of that progress. Now, of course, if you have to, at least in my opinion, if you choose between some progress and no progress, you do some progress, right, in terms of combating climate change. But if you want more durable policies, it needs to be through law because it's much harder to reverse. And that's what we see with the Inflation Reduction Act. And that gives me some hope that, some of these subsidies might last. But you already see people, saying if the Republicans take Congress, if they, take the Senate, that they're going to try to unwind some of these subsidies, which are uncapped and they're quite costly. But another thing that you can do is this idea of transparency that I talked about earlier. If you can create transparency around the benefits, it becomes clear if politicians are delivering them. You can hold them accountable if they don't. You can hold them accountable if they try to reverse these reforms. It's really hard for people to know what's happening in Washington. It's quite hard for people to know about the details of all these policies. So anything that can make it easier to identify if they're doing what they promised can help. And then, this might not particularly help your situation with solar on your home, but if we're thinking about solar in the community and how to make, build support for these types of projects, there's well documented that when you have more inclusive processes where community members are involved in discussions about, well, who gets the benefits from this project? How do they get allocated? Rather than just the developer going to the homeowner who's the only one who has this on their property, you can build broader support for having these types of projects.
I thought it was interesting. The word that kept coming up was credibility. And I can tell you out here, and it's out there as well, where you're from, the free trade agreements, you kind of compare this a little bit, some of the programs, job retraining especially, where like NAFTA is a dirty word around here still because we had a refrigerator manufacturing plant in Galesburg closed down, which is near here. The retraining programs were spotty in effectiveness at best. And I really think that goes to what you're talking about as well as credibility, that if they're going to have retrain coal miners into other jobs, what's that going to look like? I mean, what did you find out? And I know what I got to add this too, and then I'll shut up. But what I like most about your work was you went to county fairs and did an interview to bunch of people, and I know you did for the book as well. That was more for the article, but anyway, address that issue and this. I want to ask you more about your interviews as well, but.
Yeah, I mean, so you'll hear this in like in conversations, like, coal country opposes climate policy. Well, there's only 44,000 coal miners, right? If you look at the latest data, why don't we just buy them all out and, give them money to train for a new career? And, we've solved the political economy of climate change. Unfortunately, if you talk to people, they have a set of concerns. From talking to people, they're not concerned per se about their ability to transition to a new job, but they are concerned about whether or not the government will sustain its support for retraining programs, right? They've seen what's happened with decline of industries because of trade from foreign competition, and they're promised trade adjustment assistance. You know, people's incomes are lower even after they've got trade adjustment assistance. There's retraining as part of that. Their incomes also are still lower even if you got retrained than if you didn't. And so people have seen past failures and they're skeptical of these new promises, but they're also skeptical of, okay, well, if coal is the only industry in my community, what are these like new jobs that you're saying? You're saying that there's going to be like some software firm that comes to, like, Google's going to set up in Southwest Pennsylvania and hire coal miners to code. You know, it's interesting because the sort of coal miners as coders is something that is, you know, is this a classic example of, you know, out of touch ideas about how to train people to code. But there's also some examples of where it has been done right because they got the incentives right. So if you look at BitSource in Kentucky, this is a company that the way they set themselves up was, we're going to pay coal miners to code and we're going to hire them directly, which means that we have a stake, we have skin in the game, right? Because if we don't train them and they don't succeed, then our company is going to fail, right? Because we have aligned everyone's incentives, so we're rowing in the same direction. That's a company that's actually like taken off and they're starting to become profitable. So, you know, I think that it's important to think about, like, what are the incentives? What are the different jobs in their community? But I want to talk about county fairs and talk about retraining.
Yes. Go right ahead.
Because what got me interested in this project is, like, how do I talk to people? You know, I'm a political scientist at Princeton. You know, I could do, and I want to learn what coal miners think about the clean energy transition. If you just call people, you know, like your normal survey, you're not going to get a lot of, you know, coal miners in a sort of random sample of the American public, right? It's hard even to get Trump voters to answer surveys now too. This is a huge issue that people are, this sort of non-response problem, if I'm allowed to use a technical term, in public opinion polling. So what I did is, when I went to Southwest Pennsylvania, not only did I do interviews with people, but I set up a booth at a county fair and I had iPads and I surveyed people. And I was able to get, you know, people from both sides of the aisle. So if you look at the people in the survey, it's the number of Republicans matches the number of people who voted for Trump, the number of Democrats matches the number of people who voted for Biden. And I was able to ask them, you know, what do you think about climate policy? What types of policies would, you know, you support? And what's remarkable is that, you know, people will say, if I'm given, you know, transition assistance, there's investments in my community, there's compensation for lost income, I would support a climate policy. So the problem is not just sort of people are dogmatically opposed to climate policy or the energy transition. They'll say they support it. The problem is they don't think those policies are going to be delivered. They don't think those policies are going to be sustained. And, you know, given our sort of political history, these fears are not, you know, misplaced.
Exactly. I was told by a friend of mine and an attorney in Pennsylvania that, and it was funny, but it goes to a larger issue we're talking about here. He said, if you want to get in trouble, go into a local bar and find a couple iron workers and ask them what they think about green jobs. It's just, you know, people see it as a threat. And I think that goes to what you're talking about is, people may not necessarily be opposed, but it's some of the messaging that's used, and maybe there's a touch of elitism as well, I think, is a fair criticism to make.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other thing too is, you know, people are so focused on, well, let's have this one-to-one, you know, fossil fuel job to green job, you know, coal miners to solar panel installers. There is no reason that's necessary. Like, from the perspective of the energy transition, any other job that's not in fossil fuels achieves the sort of the same economic outcome in terms of making sure that someone's livelihood is not disrupted. If you can take someone who worked in the coal industry, in the oil and gas industry, here's an example. You know, the same technology that you use for fracking, hydraulic fracturing, drilling into the earth, is also used for geothermal, right? So take someone who worked in the oil and gas industry, have them work in geothermal. Some of these companies are the very same company doing the same thing. You know, that's a transition that looks much more credible to them because they know their skill set applies. They know there's going to be demand for these products. And it's not the same thing as like a solar installer. The wages are much lower. Another example of this is, in Weirton, West Virginia, there's this new form energy plant that's going in. Why do this? This is, in one way you could look at it, this is a clean energy project, but the way that the sort of the form energy explained it to people in the community is that we're building essentially batteries on the grid, and you need these batteries whether or not the grid is powered by solar or whether or not the grid is powered by coal, because they're going to help maintain sort of the stability of the electrical grid. And to tell people this is not a clean energy, this is not a fossil fuel job to green job transition, this is just common sense infrastructure that we need, framing it in that way is much more appealing to people.
I got just a couple minutes left. My final question, and we just touched on some of this. If you're interested, you'll have to, listeners, you'll have to get the book, which I recommend, and read the article. But what's interesting to me is this started, and you point this out, before Donald Trump. A lot of these trends, and I find, the trade issue started before Trump, but he's just been really effective about communicating that. A lot of people may not like how he does it, but he's been very effective in bringing people in. Is that what you witnessed there as well in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, absolutely. So the reversal that I study in the coal industry starts to happen in 2008, intensifies in 2012. So we're talking, Obama, McCain, Obama, Mitt Romney. And then you see it intensify in the Trump era, and it intensifies even more then, because Trump is directly like hammering these lines in a way that I don't think Mitt Romney or McCain was as effective a communicator on. But what's important to think about is, like, these are some economic trends that are they're deep and they're powerful, and even if Trump went away, there would still be incentives for politicians to make these appeals, and I think it would still affect the political dynamics that we see today.
Okay. Alex, thank you so much for being on today. I feel like we didn't get to everything, but I think our listeners got a good overview of what the book and the article about. Again, I'm going to list the name of the article here. It's in the Journal of Politics, Sources of Partisan Change, Evidence from the Shale Gas Shock in American Coal Country. And then Alex is also the co-author of a book called Uncertain Future, The Politics of Climate Change, How to Unlock the Climate Impasse. Like many good books, it describes the problem, but it's got some proposed solutions as well. Alex Gasmararian, has been my guest today on Heartland Politics. Alex, thank you, and good luck.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.